listening to Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting around your world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, where the time is 5:15 in the evening. Now, Declan Hughes is our Irish correspondent in Dublin, Ireland, where it's 6:15 in the morning. And Thomas Booker is in San Antonio de Bear in Texas.
Yeehaw. It's cold here in Texas right now.
And it's also 2:15 in the morning in Texas. Welcome to our show, guys.
Yep. Good to be here.
Now, Thomas, you came up with this interesting story. It's a plethora of events, as far as I can see, all intertwined.
Yes.
Lord Cardigan, dear listener, I hope you're wearing your cardigan. If you're listening in North America or Europe, you probably are. The potato famine in Ireland, Irish soldiers in Crimea and Mexico, and the story of the fatal charge of the Light Brigade. This is a powerful story. And Declan Hughes is our historian. And so I'm going to let you guys talk, and I'll come in with annoying questions from time to time. Off you go, Thomas.
Okay, well, yes. So 1850, around that time, 1850 might be the pivotal year, but it was pretty dreadful for the Irish, and up to and including the potato famine and the neglect that was offered by the British, who sort of dismissed them, of the Irish anyway. The landed gentry, who some of whom did not assist, some of whom did. But there was to the most part, it was a token soup kitchens and like some feeble food of some sort that was brought to them, but in no way helping them recover from the potato famine. And I have the other histories going down. The Irish did come to the United States of America that fled the famine, and that's where my story later on can pick up.
Yeah.
But there were two landed gentry. There was the Carnarvon was his name, Lord Carnarvon. I think he was the one who was kicked in the head by a mule.
Mm-hmm.
And was okay. I don't know if you're familiar with that story of him. And then there was Lord Cardigan, but I don't think Cardigan had anything to do with Ireland, other than the fact that he had Irish soldiers in his cavalry. Because we're talking about the Crimean War that comes up. So anyway, I'll let Declan go ahead and take what he knows with more authority than I can muster about Ireland in general.
But just to feed on from what you've been saying, Thomas, the potato famine happened from 1845 to about 1847. They were the peak years of it. Now, in the 1841 census, the census was taken every 10 years in Great Britain and Ireland, as we were then members of the United Kingdom. So in 1841, the population of Ireland was 8.5 million. And it was estimated that by 1845, the population had topped 9. And basically, most of the population in parts of rural Ireland were small tenant farmers operating on small plots of land, growing crops for their landlord, which they confiscated most of as rent. And the only crops that the people were allowed to live on were the potatoes. And everything was fine and dandy while the potatoes were healthy, because it was a healthy diet. They had buttermilk and potatoes, and they got their vegetable and their carbohydrates from the potatoes. They got the rest of their proteins from the buttermilk, and everything was fine, and the population soared. And what happened was, as you pointed out in the email that you sent to myself and Henry earlier, about the actual potato blight was caused by a particular damp summer in continental Europe in 1845. And it's reckoned that the blight itself was brought to Ireland by a ship that docked in Cork that had been in Belgium, where the potato blight had been raging right through Europe. And of course, Belgium is famous for inventing the French fry. They are, in fact, Wallonian fries. And
Why was it called the French fry? I'm intrigued.
The French fries were, in fact, invented by French-speaking Belgians. Even the Dutch-speaking Belgians give the French-speaking Belgians credit for having invented the French fry. It's that much a bone of contention and a badge of national identity for Belgians who speak either language. In fact, there's a third official language in Belgium, as a little bit of trivia for you folks. There's 250,000 people for whom German is a first language, and they call themselves Belgian citizens. So there you go. There's another little nugget for you.
Interesting.
But yes. The potato blight came to Ireland via Belgium through a boat in Cork. My father was a keen boatman and was very interested in sailing and all matters marine. And he used to bemoan the fact that the Irish people had very little interest in the sea. And he told a story. He says, if you've got a person from every country in the world, the Irishman would turn his back to the sea. And I said, yes, Dad, that's because we got two things from the sea, the potato blight and the Brits. So that's the reason why we don't have any time for the sea.
Thomas, thoughts on that?
Yes, there was other aspects to it too. It was a monoculture, and in terms of that particular crop. And if you have a single variety crop, you can have something like that be affected by a blight that can come in.
Yeah.
And I think
variety of the potato as well, which the Irish were growing, and that was part of the problem. But the other problem was that they were actually growing food to give to the landlords, who were then exporting it. So at a time when the Irish were starving to death, food was being exported in very large numbers from the island of Ireland to feed Great Britain.
Yes, and sorry to interrupt you, Declan. It's an interesting point. And Sinead O'Connor, of course, famously sang that song. And she talked about... She cited the idea that, and I'm sure she's probably not quite correct about this, that there was no famine. What are your thoughts on that? Because they did export the food that the Irish grew. They took over their farms, of course, didn't they?
Well, I think if we have to put this in context. Thomas, are you familiar with the clearances in Scotland?
I'm not. No, I have to confess.
Okay. In Scotland, we had a similar situation with small tenant farmers, particularly in the Northern Highlands. And the landlords in Scotland, or the lairds as they were known, did their sums and worked out it'd be far more economical for them to clear their farms of the tenant farmers and replace them with sheep. So that's what they did. And a lot of Scots had to emigrate because of that.
Gosh.
And so they reckoned that what happened with the potato famine here was the Irish version of the clearances in Scotland. It's just they used the potato blight to achieve the same thing.
Huh. That was, yeah, I was also hearing something about Southern Atlantic Ocean near, it's off the coast of South America, there was an island. This is off, you know, it's, but there was an island that was a bird sanctuary and had been so for, you know, thousands of years, and it was covered with massive quantities of guano. That were mined and brought, and I heard something to the effect that it could possibly be some of that guano was brought in and tilled into the fields in Ireland, but the potatoes and other things, but the potatoes were susceptible to a particular blight that was brought in by that guano. But that's another speculation. I can't say that it's for sure.
Yeah, that might have been one source of the blight, but the main source is attributed to that ship I told you about, the Dublin Cork.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly the blight that affected the southern part of the country was definitely connected to that particular ship from Belgium. But there was a potato blight raging throughout Europe. And as I said earlier, Belgium, the home of the French fry, it was a place where a lot of potatoes were being grown. And their potato crops failed in the same years that the Irish crops failed. The difference being is that the Belgians had other stuff to eat.
Yes. They weren't dependent totally on a potato crop.
Correct.
And then the rest of Ireland had regular crops that they were selling to England and overseas, to France and Europe, making a profit on it. And they didn't want to lose their profits by having to feed starving Irishmen.
Yeah, and it's just the people in the coastal communities, interestingly enough, because they had access to fish, didn't suffer as badly as those inland.
Huh. That's yes. I was always wondering about that, since Ireland was essentially an island, why there weren't more diverse foodstuffs, especially fish and other.
That's a very good point. Lots of fishing on the west coast.
The coastal communities, to be fair, on the whole, didn't suffer as much because they had access to fish. But again, fish has a bad reputation in Ireland because, as Henry will tell you, Ireland was a predominantly Roman Catholic country. And up to about 40 years ago, if you were Roman Catholic, you couldn't eat meat on a Friday. You were forced to eat fish.
Correct.
So fish was seen as penitential. And then, of course, because there was only fish to eat other than potatoes during the famine, in certain parts of the world, it was seen as famine food.
Gosh. Huh. That's how interesting.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like if you were from Ethiopia and you were getting these dried biscuits that they send to the starving people of Ethiopia. They fill a gap, but once the famine's over, you don't want to see one of those famine biscuits ever again.
I bet you don't.
And the Irish had the same attitude to fish.
Interesting tidbit. In case listeners, at the start of this, I mentioned that, you know, at the jump, if you're wearing a jumper, we can call it a cardigan, and it actually comes from Lord Cardigan. And just another.
It does, but it's a particular type of jumper, Henry. It's the one with the buttons down the front.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Which were very popular in the 1960s, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I just.
But cardigan is actually cardigan's actually a place in Wales.
Yes, I know. And that makes it even more complex.
And there's a very big bay called Cardigan Bay, which is on the west coast of Wales.
Right.
So that area that he was the lord of was quite a substantial piece of land.
Right.
Right.
So we have there's the migration of the Irish to the United States. They basically left. They checked out, and I don't know how they survived making it across the Atlantic.
A lot of them
died on the boats, actually.
Well, I call them the coffin yes. ships, Declan.
Coffin ships, indeed. Yeah. Mm.
Oh, yes.
Thomas.
And then the worst part of it was when they arrived in the United States, they were immigrants, and they were treated with the harshest of contempt because they were afraid that, once again, exactly the thing that we're having here on the border and having immigrants, and exactly the thing they're having in Europe with the people escaping from the Arab Spring.
Yes.
It's that they're going to steal our jobs. They're going to steal everything, you know, and they're going to be a burden on us. And the Irish came, you know, got introduced into the United States en masse. I mean, there are many more who had trickled in, but this was a massive migration.
And they did have a terrible name in America in that time. You know, on pub walls, and Declan, we've talked about this before. You know, on the window, if you're going into a pub, you see no blacks or Irish, and this is in America. The Irish were causing problems everywhere. Let's face it; they were having fights and brawls.
And they were. There have been one example, one really atrocious example later on of another immigrant group who were brought in, were the Chinese, who were excellent laborers, who the workers that stuck to the task of really hard labor in terms of pounding out the path, digging out the path for the railroad tracks to follow, and especially in mining and other aspects where they excelled. There was, after the railroads were established in the United States around 1960, it became serious. They were around 1866 or 67. By 1870, there was the rails were built and expanding, and the next great industry that was going to be opened up were the mines and the mining industry. And I have read accounts where people felt their jobs in the mines were going to be stolen once again by the Chinese because they were such dogged, determined laborers. And I heard of one instance in the 1870s or so of part of town, which they would call, I guess, Chinatown, where there was actually an entire segment of the town where they were the Chinese were massacred out of fear that they would be a threat to the other people who wanted to claim their right to work in the mines. So that's one example, but the other example of that I wanted to cite later on when the plot turns is the San Patricio Battalion. But first, I'd like to yield to the accounts of the Irish who had to go to war, who joined in and became soldiers in the Crimean War.
And how did that happen?
Again, to add to this point, Thomas, and it's good that you raise it. There used to be a tradition in Ireland that if you had three sons, the first one got the farm, the second one was sent to the church, and the third guy had to join the British Army.
And that, you wouldn't want to be the third son.
You didn't want to be the third son. So, and again, it's funny because you might find this interesting, Henry. A similar pattern was seen in the, shall we say, less well-to-do Church of Ireland community, where if they had three children, one got the farm, one joined, became a vicar, and the third guy joined the British Army as well. It was kind of like a pattern that was seen in the, shall we say, middle to lower class, financially speaking, across the board in Ireland, because, you know, only one person was going to get the farm, and they'd only have enough money to send one person to become a priest or vicar, you know. So that's basically the way it worked. And so the third guy frequently took what was called the king's shilling back in the day, or the queen's shilling, but it was Queen Victoria, and it would have been Queen Victoria during most of the period we're talking about now. And so that was the only option for third sons. And in fact, my great great grandfather was from County Offaly, and he was the third son of the family, and he took the queen's shilling. And as a result, my mother's father was born in Cairo in Egypt, because my great grandfather was in a barracks in Cairo with his wife when she gave birth.
Wow, what a story.
Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables, were shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people starved. And then, in the middle of all this, they gave us money not to teach our children Irish. And so we lost our history, and this is what I think is still hurting me. See, we're like a child that's been battered, has to drive itself out of its head because it's frightened, still feels all the painful feelings. But they lose contact with the memory, and this leads to massive self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, all desperate attempts at running. And in its worst form becomes actual killing. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? An American army regulation says you mustn't kill more than 10% of a nation, because to do so causes permanent psychological damage. It's not permanent, but they didn't know that. Anyway, during the supposed famine, we lost a lot more than 10% of our nation through deaths on land or in ships of emigration. But what finally broke us was not starvation, but its use in the controlling of our education. Schools go on about Black 47, on and on about the terrible famine. But what they don't say is, in truth, there really never was one.
Excuse me.
Oh, the lonely people.
Sorry, excuse me.
Where do they all come? So let's take a look, shall we? The highest statistics of child abuse in the EEC, and we say we're a Christian country, but we've lost contact with our history. See, we used to worship God as a mother. We're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Look at all our old men in the pubs. Look at all our young people on drugs. We used to worship God as a mother. Now look at what we're doing to each other. We've even made killers of ourselves, the most childlike, trusting people in the universe. And this is what's wrong with us. Our history books, the parent figures lied to us. I see the Irish as a race like a child that got itself bashed in the face. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding.
Shooting each other. There is no real invader here. We are all Irish. must not now or ever in the future show anything to each other except tolerance, forbearance, and neighborly love.
Because of our traditions, everyone here knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Just joined us. I'm Henry from Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia. And of course, I'm talking with Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas and Declan Hughes in Dublin, Ireland. I want to get into this whole business of Irish soldiers in Crimea and indeed, Thomas, down the road from you in Mexico. How did all this come about? It just seems so bizarre to me.
Well, I mean, the third son joined the military, and
Why so far away? I mean, I don't understand. I can understand.
There was a conflict between the Russians, and believe it or not, I think the British were protecting the Ottoman Empire's right to certain regions that were being opposed by the Russians. There was a clash, and it had to do with access of religious people to these areas in what we now laughingly called the Holy Land, but they, in order to defend that access, the British Army intervened and went to war with Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, Russia, this was the Imperial Russia. They used to have the Tsar, and they had like a post-Napoleonic military structure, and that was when the British managed to make port in Sevastopol. And were able to march into Crimea and work their way up, but they were blocked by the Russian military lines in northern Crimea, and so there were Irish soldiers fighting alongside that, and I don't know how many the cavalry charge. I don't know how many Irish were involved in that and part of the troop makeup that made the regiment that went into the cannon. Of course, charged into the cannons.
So obviously, Thomas, the connection is that the Irish people went into the British Army, who were all over the world, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. But so that, and then, but the thing that I heard, another interesting aspect was that there was a medical regiment, a medical corps that was made up. And this is going in parallel with Florence Nightingale and her efforts, the one who brings sanitation and proper medical and sanitary conditions to wounded soldiers and treating them, that there was a parallel group of Irishmen who moved in, who of Irish, and I think there was men and women, nurses and whatnot, who had a separate what you call a medical brigade or medical company that also treated the wounded and...
Is this the Light Brigade you're talking about?
No, the Light Brigade is something totally... That's Lord Cardigan.
Okay. I'll let you continue talking.
No, but this was in parallel with the Florence Nightingale. I'm just saying that there was and it came from Ireland, and I was kind of curious about that. It was organized and sent from Ireland as a aid station and a hospital corps for to treat the wounded soldiers I guess restore some of them to fighting ability and others to, dress them up and get them ready to get shipped back to England or wherever else, with missing legs and limbs and blind and everything else for that particular war. So, but they said that it rivaled Florence Nightingale in terms of the hygiene practices and the sophistication of the treatment at that time. So I don't know if anybody's familiar with that corps.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, Thomas, because even to this day, Irish nurses and medical staff are prized all around the world. I mean, there's a lot of Irish nurses operating in Great Britain in the National Health Service. There's a lot of Irish nurses out near where Henry is these days in Australia.
As you know,
there's a lot of them in the United Arab Emirates as well.
I spend a lot of time. I do spend a lot of time in hospital these days because I'm on chemo. And the Irish are everywhere in the hospitals. They're everywhere. And this, as you say, Declan, in London particularly, but mostly anywhere in Britain, it's always Irish nurses. We are known as a caring species, us Irish, aren't we?
We are, yeah. And it's one of the things that we've become good at over the years. Ironically, the British tell anti-Irish jokes, making out that we're stupid, but they do state exams across the United Kingdom, Thomas, every year, and the best results every year, year on year, in the so-called United Kingdom are always found in Northern Ireland.
Wow. Okay. That's
which, of course, is an English territory. Which is interesting.
Yeah, but it's full of Irish people is my point, Henry.
Yes,
they tell
jokes
about the Irish being stupid.
Well, I think we've become a little more politically correct in recent times, I'm sure. And you know, when you look at US presidents, I don't want to really go down that road, but they always claim to be Irish, probably for political reasons. But yeah, I mean,
there's 40 million reasons why they claim to be Irish, Henry.
40 million reasons. I know where you're going with this. The Americans all think they're Irish. Thomas, are you Irish?
No, I'm some kind of amalgam of Northern European. I think I'm going to be more like Welsh or something like that. Okay. I can't declare my genome to be Irish.
Well, I always say, Thomas, Barack Obama was 164th Irish. That's good enough for me.
It will definitely do. And that's...
Sorry, yes, go on.
Well, no, I'm just saying that when the wave of Irishmen came into the United States, they were initially disdained. And I mean, basically the same way, the same dismissal and ridicule given to them that would be given to Mexicans or Italians or whoever else immigrated. But I remember a depiction of the Irish who came in that used to be way back when I was a kid, and St. Patrick's Day would come around and they would have all these storefronts having St. Patrick's Day sales. And aside from the shamrock and the clover and all that stuff,
and the green Guinness.
Yeah, the green, yes. And well, the depiction of Irishmen, and I think this is a holdover from mid-century, from mid-19th century, but the way that they were depicted, they would have the little hat, the little black hat with the buckle on it, and they'd be wearing kind of like a leprechaun outfit.
Yeah.
But their faces were drawn in such a way that they had kind of narrow eyes and small nose and a large jaw with kind of a straight lip, and then these features of cheeks, and it made them look like they were monkeys.
Yeah, that comes from a British cartoon magazine called Punch.
Ah, really? Okay.
That's where it originated. That's why I don't sort of go harp on about this, but that's why the Notre Dame logo for the Fighting Irish could be deemed politically offensive if we were to take that view, because of the fact that it has those characteristics that you just described.
Yes.
Declan, I just want to ask you this, as a fellow Irishman myself. Do you ever feel, you know, as I grew up, the Americans, you know, international tourists came to Ireland, and they were mostly Americans wearing appalling clothes, very loud clothes, like they were on a golf course all the time. And I sort of felt a little belittled, and no offense, Thomas Booker in Texas.
Well, you should have felt.
We just felt like they, you know, this like pixie kind of attitude towards the Irish. I, you know, even as a young fella, I did find that kind of offensive, Declan.
Yeah, but you see, what we've learned to do in Ireland is we've learned to turn that into dollars, tourist
dollars. Good point. Yes,
we have a leprechaun museum, Thomas, in Dublin.
Oh dear.
Yes.
It's a big attraction with American tourists. I remember my dad had a temporary job at one point before they emigrated to Canada, where I lived for 6 years when I was a child, where he had to drive tourists around as a fill-in bus driver for this company that he knew. And he had been running a business, and he was in the construction industry, and they were on strike, so he took whatever work he could get. And he was asked by an American tourist once when he was driving this minibus, had he ever seen a leprechaun? He said, no. And he was asked, why not? He said, well, I'm not an American tourist.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I just want to point out, just, we were talking about Lord Cardigan. He used to, the junior British cavalry took the piss out of him quite a few times because he actually had a lisp. He had a lisp, and they copied his mannerisms and his lisp, of his lisp, and it affected his... Well, he mispronounced a lot of things. And the British are known for, with R's, they become W's, if you know what I mean. W's instead of R's.
W's phonetic, yeah. It's like a British thing. Movie, The Life of Brian, where they had the guy with the R problem. So he was asked to release Waterwick and release Wadger, you know?
Yeah, that was... And I hear BBC, they have a strange... when I hear news reports and stuffing that are... they have every now and then they have a strange speech pattern that they tend to do, emphasize the R's at the end of their words. And it's a kind of peculiar thing because I keep thinking it's really odd because the BBC.
Well, I need to give you a bit of background on this, Thomas. Henry might remember this. Did you ever have a speech and drama teacher in school?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I didn't, but I did get trained briefly by the BBC.
Yeah, we got one in primary school, in my primary school. I wasn't sure because you were in boarding school for a while, so I wasn't sure what setup was there.
And it has to be said, it was a Protestant boarding school, and they were very different, really.
But the speech and drama teacher we had insisted on us going around the rugged rocks, the ragged rascal ran, and that's where this R thing comes from, you know.
Gosh. It's interesting because, in the 80s when I was a newsreader on, stations like Radio Nova in Dublin, I had more of a British accent because it was kind of cool and trendy. Now, bear in mind that the owner of this rather large pirate radio station, Chris Carey, was British. And there was a trend for, even here in Australia, even as late as the 1980s, commentators, reporters had a kind of an English tinge into their accent, and it was just the done thing. And it comes back, if you can go back to the 1940s when television later started in America, and the BBC was well on its way with radio, even the reporters in Britain sounded like the king. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, there was definitely an element of that. But anyway, in fairness to you and in fairness to the radio station you were working for in Ireland in the 1980s at the time, he was trying to target a British audience. And I think he was looking to get 75% of his listenership and revenue from that source. So it was probably not a bad thing at all that you were at least intelligible to a UK audience.
Yes, it's a good answer. Thank you for that. Thomas Booker in Texas. The Americans don't mess around with accents at all. I don't know what your local TV station there in Texas, if they've all got Texas accents. But generally,
they all get rid of that. They have it's a long time ago. All the announcers, they had a thing called the Mid-Atlantic accent.
Oh yes.
Yep.
I think it was yes. Yep. And so they would all cultivate their diction and their pronunciation. News presenters and hosts and all of those personalities on TV, and especially with the local stations around here, have gotten rid of the Texas drawl. Unless they're a coach, unless they're a football coach, then that's acceptable.
Yes.
They don't talk with the old cowboy drawl. They have their proper diction, and it's just they do sound like it wound up being like John Lennon used to say, "Hello, I'm from nowhere." It was the kind of like the Kansas accent or the mid-states accent that was just a blend. The Nebraska accent was what I was trying to think of, which everybody sort of adopted later on in the 60s and further on. Like Johnny Carson had it, and the other people. They did get rid of the what would be considered to be a hick provincial accent.
I have a story here, Thomas
and Henry. Sorry to cut across you, Henry.
No, that's okay.
Henry, do you remember Radio Luxembourg in the 70s and 80s?
Of course I do. Nova tried to compete with Luxembourg in the 80s.
Do you remember Bob Stewart?
Yes, I do.
Bob Stewart was a native of Liverpool. Thomas might find this interesting. So Bob Stewart had a Liverpool accent like the Beatles.
He did.
And he thought when the Beatles were huge, he thought he'd go over to America and try and get a job. But no, he couldn't get a job with his... He couldn't get any work.
They couldn't understand him.
So he went over to America. He learned an American mid-Atlantic accent, as you described it. Came back home to Europe and had a career for 30, 40 years with his mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah, there you go. The accent does it all for you, you know. If you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia. And I'm talking with Thomas Booker and Declan Hughes. Declan's in Dublin. Thomas is in San Antonio de Bahia.
Yeehaw!
Now, I just want to, you know, we're talking about Lord Cardigan and how the Cardigan was named after him. Here's a fun fact. Did you know about Sandwich? John Montagu, yes, 4th Earl of Sandwich, an 18th century English aristocrat. It is commonly said that Lord Sandwich, during long sessions of cribbage, whatever the hell that is, and other card games...
It's a card game, I think.
...at public gambling houses, would order his valet to bring him a salt beef between two pieces of toasted bread. Did he really invent the sandwich? Really?
He popularized it.
He popularized it. Right. Now, I want to just chat. We're centering this around, you know, the Earl of Cardigan. The Battle of Balaclava in 1854 was a thing with regard to obviously the infamous charge of the Light Brigade against Russian forces. And we have talked briefly about that. That was a big deal, wasn't it, Thomas?
Yes, there was a, what was this? It was inanity and stupidity, because once again, I mean, there were, you know, the heroic charge of this, they were leaning back to their Napoleonic mentality. And what happened was there was a heavily fortified artillery brigade up on across a bridge. I mean, it's a ridge, a piece of highland. And the Lord Cardigan et al. Had assured them that their horsemen would be able to come in and take it out. And so they were given the permission, and they didn't really realize what it was they were going to actually be charging into, but they just sort of dismissed the what artillery they thought that was going to be there as just a mere bother. And so when the time came, then there's the great poem that was written later as the aftermath of that charge was the cannons to the right of them, cannons to the left of them, into the valley of death rode the 600. And it's it's god awful that you have the officer, the British officer corps, the elite social class, and leading their ordinary citizens in uniform up and charging up and trying to take out the cannons, and they were basically blown to pieces. I think about 3/4 of the regiment was blown out. When they came back, they were just in tatters. And I don't know if Cardigan was killed in that or not. I don't have the information about that. But it was just, and then once again, a lot of the ordinary soldiers who were involved in that were Irish recruits who had their share of casualties and bloodshed in it. And it basically accomplished nothing. It was a complete waste of men and cavalry. And it just wound up becoming it wound up being a metaphor for futility and stupidity for a long, long time. This was also taking place in Crimea, which is below Ukraine, and going against Russian soldiers, who I guess by 1850 many of them were still experienced with having fought off Napoleon, earlier on.
Declan, thoughts on that?
Yeah, that would have been about 40 years earlier that the Russian army would have fought off Napoleon. Yeah, no, it's a fair point. It's just to give a bit of background to the listeners. People will be wondering, why did the British side with the Ottoman Empire in this particular thing? But what people have to remember is the Ottoman Empire was unlike the image we have of modern-day Islam. The Ottoman Empire was actually quite tolerant to Christians. And in fact, they encouraged Christians and Jews to visit the holy sites in modern-day Israel at the time. So why the British were siding with the Ottomans was the Ottomans were making shall we say, it possible for people to go there on pilgrimages and visit the holy sites, because Jerusalem and the sites were also sacred to the Muslims. So it was kind of like, basically, it was as tolerant as the proponents of Islam would like you to believe the religion is today. And right. that was part of it.
And that's the weird part about it, too. The Ottoman Empire, at that time, they controlled Greece and all the Lebanon and yep. all the way down what they call the Holy Land. I guess all the way to Egypt, right?
All the way to Egypt, yeah, absolutely. And here's one for you, Henry. You mightn't know this, but the way the Ottomans would operate is they would beat your king in a battle. And then what they would do is, if they killed your king in the battle, they would take the prince, the princesses, and all the next generation of the royal family, take them back to Istanbul, train them up in the Ottoman way of doing things, and then send them back to govern you.
Gosh.
So
you wouldn't rebel because your Ottoman governor was one of your own royal family.
Gosh.
Wasn't that clever?
Very smart indeed.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Ottoman Empire lasted as long as it did.
Yeah, they were, I guess, a sophisticated society, a little bit more so than present.
One of the classic examples of the shrewdness of the Ottoman Empire was modern-day Bosnia-Herzegovina. There were settled farmers in the central part around what's now Sarajevo.
Right.
And then there were, shall we say, nomadic tribes to the west who would be modern-day Croats, and nomadic Orthodox religion tribes to the east who'd be modern-day Serbs. And they used to come down into the central plains and raid the farms and steal their cattle and so on. And the Ottomans rocked up to these farmers and said, look, if you convert to Islam, we'll protect you from the nomads. And the Bosnians said, that sounds like a deal to us. And that's why modern-day Bosnia is Muslim.
Yes.
I just want to mention, I've been doing a bit of research. There was a film in 1960 called Exodus.
Oh, God.
And that was very, very controversial. And it was about a ship. Someone fill me in because I haven't got my notes here.
No, it actually happened. There was a shipload of people from Cyprus who they made a big deal out of it. What they did was the fellow who wrote the novel, Leon Uris, had worked up a set of characters and made a drama out of it. And Paul Newman played, it was Paul Newman and Eva Marie Saint. And but it was, there was a controversy. They've actually went on a hunger strike on the ship. And at some point, the humanitarian aspect of it, because they were full of refugees from Europe who were Jews, and they wanted to go to make it to Israel and into Palestine. And so that really did happen, but the drama that was written about it was appalling.
Well, they say Thomas, that it was very loosely based, and the actual movie in 1960, to say the very least, I'm sure it was. The State of Israel was created in 1948, resulting in a war with its Arab neighbors.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with with me, though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong. The help of God, I know I can be strong to make this land our home. If I must fight, I'll fight to make this land our own until.
Yes. Declan, are you open? Have you seen this film?
I saw it donkeys years ago.
Me too. Yeah.
Two things that I remember from that movie is that the composer of the soundtrack was Andrew Gold's father. Do you remember Andrew Gold?
Is that right?
Thomas, yes. Yeah, Ernest Gold was his father, wrote the theme music for that and all the incidental music in the movie as well. The other thing about that was Leon Uris also wrote a book about Ireland called Trinity.
Interesting.
Yeah, and in it, he highlighted something, in fairness to him, he did his research, he highlighted something which I hadn't been aware of, that there'd been professional rugby league in what's now Northern Ireland in the late 19th century. I hadn't been aware of that.
Gosh. Right, and you know, this particular movie, I won't sound too long, but it is the theme, of course, very loosely based, of course, is the founding of the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. And it starts with a ship filled with Jewish immigrants bound for Israel who are being offloaded on Cyprus, as you've mentioned, Thomas. An intelligent
background for you, Henry. Sorry to cut across.
No, that's
there
okay.
There was actual migration of Jewish people to Palestine from the end of the First World War, and they used to go to Israel and they used to buy land from the Arabs and live peacefully next door to them.
Yes, it was before that. It was Theodor Herzl who founded Zionism, and he actually started having immigrants come in 1895.
Yeah.
Before that. And I don't have any insight because I haven't really read anything about the era then when there was Palestine and then these colonies, these kibbutzes. He started the system of kibbutzes.
Yeah,
you mean kibbutzes?
Kibbutz.
Yeah. And Thomas, Henry lived in a kibbutz for a while.
I did indeed. I was in Israel for a year.
That's right. You're in it.
I got to just tell you a quick funny story about living in Israel and being on a kibbutz for most of the time, although I did work as a cleaner in a very rich house in Herzliya 3 in Tel Aviv. But in the kibbutz, we were paid. A little bit of money, not much, but we were given free cigarettes. Now, I was with my girlfriend and my friend, so the three of us, they didn't smoke, but I did. So I got three sets of cigarettes. They were called Noblis cigarettes, and they were fine. They also gave us condoms, and this is 1983. And I just thought, wow, these people are so responsible. Not so much with the cigarettes, but definitely with the condoms. Israel was an absolute blast. I don't know if either of you have been there, but it was an incredible place to live in. Surrounded by Arab states and heavily financed militarily by the United States of America, of course.
Well, I mean, that's also, it sort of plays into, it was post-World War One, Lawrence of Arabia, I don't know if you remember him. The whole thing about his unified the Arab nations to resist the Ottoman Empire and push the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine. And the thing was that he was going to try to have an Arabian nation, and there would be a Bedouin coalition to rule the area. But he was overridden by I think it's the Sykes-Picot Agreement that was prior to the end of World War I, where the areas in Palestine would be given to Britain and France as colonies, which wound up betraying all the Arabs that the Arab nationals that Lawrence tried to organize and then supported for them to have an independent state, which was blown away. As a matter of fact, R. Lawrence was in there. He was in 1919 at the peace conference in Paris, and he was advocating for the liberation of the Arab states and their nationhood at the same time that Ho Chi Minh was there trying to lobby to have Vietnam released as an independent nation from France. And this was the whole grounding for all the later catastrophes.
And Thomas, another bit of background for you. The Irish Free State was trying to negotiate to get itself recognized as being independent following the 1918 British election, where the pro-independence party won most of the seats for Ireland, and we couldn't even get a hearing.
But that was also now 1919, the Irish Revolution. It was the revolution 1916 that was happening.
Yeah, but there was an election in 1918 just after the war, Thomas, a British election, and the Sinn Féin Independence Party at the time got 106 of something like 120 available seats for Ireland. And so they used that as they declared UDI and set up a parliament building in what's now the Lord Mayor's house in the city centre of Dublin. There's an assembly room attached to the Lord Mayor's house, and that was where Dáil Éireann sat for the first time. This was before Leinster House, Henry.
Yes, and of course, Dáil Éireann is the Irish Parliament. It's interesting that we're talking, you know, about Lawrence of Arabia, which was a contentious. This was all about the warring Arab tribes during World War One, and then, of course, the other film that we were talking about, Exodus, which is 1960. Lawrence of Arabia is 1962, and of course, you know, very famous actors of the time were in that, and you know, Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, I mean, Anthony Quinn, Jack Hawkins, they were all in this. Yeah. It was a huge film. And an interesting little story I read somewhere about this. You know the way they're running around over the sand dunes with camels?
Yes.
At a great, dangerous pace. Lawrence O'Toole, and I can't remember who he was with, I think it was Anthony Quinn, or Alec Guinness maybe, they got pissed. They got drunk. They got stupidly drunk before they did that scene.
I just got the name of him, his Omar Sharif. But they would, whenever there was going to be a lull and they were setting up some shots and stuff and they had time off, they would go to Cairo and get drunk and gamble and come back and be completely wasted. And that was the camel charge. Supposedly, O'Toole said that he was, when they had the intense look on his face as he was riding the camel into battle, and he said he was completely pissed.
Yes.
and almost fell off the camel and all of that. That was... there's the other movie I'd like to cite, basically, also, since we're talking about Crimea. In 1968, there was a motion picture called The Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah.
And it is a great movie. It's a fantastic movie. It is almost borders on satire because they played it with such straight Victorian.
Yes.
And it was David Hemmings and... a really great cast, fantastic cast. And Trevor Howard played Lord Cardigan.
Yes.
If you can get it on, streaming video, it should be available on YouTube. I can't believe it wouldn't be. But it was a brilliantly constructed film. And a lot of it, whenever they would fade away, where they would have the conflicts and everything, they would have it. They would go to cartoons from the London Times of that era, and they would take the cartoons and kind of animate them in such a way.
Sorry, Declan, you sound like you've seen this. Because I haven't seen this.
I saw it. Yeah, and I just as a follow up to the point that Thomas was making, was the tactical blunders that the British Army used in their battles in Crimea were still being used right up to the end of the First World War. And it's one of the reasons why so many soldiers died in the First World War. Now, this is an interesting statistic that you might find news to you, Henry. Mm. The First World War lasted 4 years. 750,000 British troops got killed. The Second World War lasted 6 years, had better technology, better airplanes, etc., etc., etc. 500,000 British troops got killed in a longer war with better weapons. That goes to show you how ridiculous the tactics used in the First World War were. 250,000 people, you could say, needlessly killed.
Yes, yeah, and one of the classic case was Winston Churchill's attacking the soft underbelly of Europe through the Gallipoli. And then, that was a catastrophe, of course.
His mom was American, by the way, Thomas.
Yes, his wife was American. Yes, I saw that movie too. There was another really good movie made about him. But anyway, he did the same thing over again in World War II when he thought he would send troops in to try to arrest Greece from the Germans.
Yes,
and he got them. He was going to attack the soft underbelly of Europe, and it was a disastrous.
Him with his big cigar.
Yeah, him with his big cigar, and it was a catastrophe. The Germans completely surrounded the British assault force, and took prisoners, and they lost hundreds of thousands of men. But that was, and then Greece remained in the German hands all the way to the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And also, there was a really stupid movie made that was written by the novel was written by Alistair MacLean of it was, this whole fantasy about sending a troop of, commandos, a few good men getting into, the guns of Navarone. They were going to take it out. And so they went, they had 12 good fellows landing on the island to
get to fight them on the beaches.
Yes, they would silence the guns, and allow them.
You know, this might sound like a really ignorant question. We got to go in a second. My God, we're so over time. I wonder, someone mentioned to me that Churchill wasn't prime minister for the whole of the Second World War. Surely that's...
He only took over in 1940.
Yeah. Chamberlain starts in 39 to 45.
Yeah, Chamberlain was prime minister at the start of the war. Chamberlain was the guy that negotiated the peace agreement with Hitler in 38. And he was still in power until about the end of 39-40, and then there was a kind of a heave against him.
Yes.
Well, that is fascinating. Yeah.
And the war cabinet consisted of all the major political parties. They were all on side and they were all singing off the same hymn sheet, which was a good idea when you're fighting a war.
Yeah, especially, England against the whole of the German, Germany and...
Yeah, yeah.
England against all of Europe by that time, yes.
Well, at that stage, yeah. Okay, we have to go. It's fascinating talking to you two at the same time. And I did manage to get a word in, and I'm very pleased about that. So, Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas. We never did get that beer.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. Maybe next time. And Declan Hughes... I'm taking this very personally, Thomas. and Declan Hughes in Dublin, Ireland. Thank you both for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Declan, it's really good talking with you. We need to do another show together.
Well, we need to talk about the San Patrizio thing the next time.
We never got around to it this time round. Yes,
next time. Okay, guys, thank you so much. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Very Real Radio.
sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.